3 days running, and the rest of the days were, you know, 98. And we sat there sweating, and every time we got up off our cushions, there were these great pools of water. But, if that's what there is, that's what there is, and you put out lots of pitchers of water, but it's not necessary. It's not better. This is not a martial art. Pardon the Rinzai tradition. It's working? All right. Now, see, when Zen arrived in Japan, and the Soto and Rinzai schools got going, and there was some competition, who's going to get to have the big emperor-supported temple in Kyoto, which was then the capital, and the Rinzais got it, and the Sotos didn't. The Dogen left town, basically, and went off into the country and developed a monastery. And the Rinzai Zen was there on the scene as the samurai culture and the arts sort of developed, and the influence there was very profound and very, in many ways, very, very beautiful and very good. Flower arranging and all that. Tea ceremony developed out of our Orioki meals. Those of you who feel who know what Orioki is, that's the origin of tea ceremony in terms of the form. And the warrior caste, the samurai culture, got very interested in Zen too, and so they each got something out of it, and each lost something. As I say, Zen became, Rinzai Zen especially, became sort of imbued with a martial air. And we all had a little bit of that. Cross between martial and we're all being ascetic monks. Only we're lay people living in the world, but it came as a monastic practice. There we were all sitting like this. You'd see Katagiri Roshi sitting, he'd have this frown. And that was sweet, gentle, and kind at all other times. So, but Soto Zen was less so. They used to say that Rinzai Zen was warrior Zen and Soto Zen was farmer Zen because it had flourished in the country originally. So we're not doing a martial art. But we are doing a body practice. And we're doing a practice that says, oh, is this your life right now? Here we are. And that's actually what I want to talk about today, is this my life? Oh, here I am. What am I going to do with it? I started last week talking about the mind of the way. Fundamentally, we are already completely in the way. And at the same time, we have to constantly exert ourselves to clarify our lives, to follow the way. We can't just say, oh, I'm already here, I am already in the Buddha way, and not do something. So I started, though, last week talking about two aspects of the mind of the way, so it doesn't just sound like some abstraction. And one was, what I talked about was the sense of direction, mostly. What the way is, way and path, and I talked about that some. And then I talked about that this is not a path with a goal to be reached, but with a sense of direction here and now. Where I am now and where I go from here. How do I orient myself? Sure, in what direction to what, where maybe where I might like to get to, but that's only really important as how do I orient now? Where I might want to get to. You'll never get to where you think you're going, but where you think you might want to get to, if that influences you to say, now, how do I live here with a sense of direction? That's fine. When I wanted to ordain, Katagiri Roshi said, yes, he would like to ordain me. And then he said, will you wait? Wait. And then he said, when I got a little tired of waiting after 8 weeks, and it turned into 8 years. He said, It's as long as you're going in the direction of ordaining, it doesn't matter if you ever get there. Well, that was not true for me. It absolutely mattered that I would get there. But what really most mattered was how was I going to live today with wanting that and not just yearning for it. That would have been awful, year after year, just kind of falling over yearning. I had to live where I was. So I had a sense of direction going toward ordaining, wanting it badly. So then I had to live right now with wanting something badly that isn't here. That was my life right now. So it was all, again, about my life here and now. So that's that sense of direction. You know, we say endlessly, be here now, right? And that can become, it's very facile because in some sense, be here now on any level, it's fine, but it seems kind of casual. But there are so many levels of it. Yes, be here now, but who can really do that? It's a little bit like the old Zen story about the governor or whoever who is studying Zen of some province who goes to see the famous Zen master. In this case, it's Bird's Nest Roshi up in his tree. And he looks up, it's one of my favorites, Bird's Nest up in his tree. So he looks up at him and says, you know, what is the essence of the way? And he says, do what is good, refrain from doing what is harmful, benefit all beings. And the governor says, even a child of three knows that. That's basically good advice. Even a child of three knows that. And Bird's Nest says, and even a man of 80 can't do it. So it's in that same spirit. So be here now is something to aim at for your entire life, but in an increasingly refined way. It's too vague. Just what's here and what's now and what does that mean about past and future and me? What about the suffering here and now? What about that? And how do you do that in a way that doesn't impoverish what's here and now by casting out the other things? That's easy. I'll be here and now and I won't think about all the other things. Impoverishes your life tremendously because there's not much left if everything, so much gets pushed out. And this is a practice of how do you be present here and now, including everything that has to do with your life, past, present, and future. And that's when we aim in that direction. That's when we talk about living in the 10-direction universe, the past, present, and all future, those three directions, and all the other directions around us are the universe of right here and now where I live. The other word I used talking about direction was intention. You know, I had an intention to ordain. We have an intention to do something. But this is, and I don't think I clarified, this is not the usual kind of, the Buddhist meaning of that word intention is not wishful thinking. You know, in English, normal English, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions because these are nice ideas, good ideas. I would like to. New Year's resolution ideas, you know. That's not what it means. That's not what it means. It means the direction your action goes in. So when we have precepts or vows, we're saying, how are you going to direct your feet? How are you going to move? Where are you actually going to go? Direction is where are you going to go next? What is this moment going to be made of? This moment is made of going in some direction. So it's not just an idea orienting you and you do or you don't. It's a sense of active direction, which is why we sometimes use the word vow instead of intention, because that has a sense of embodied activity. But for some people, vow has bad connotations of old religious associations. So we have to hold all our words loosely. So this one aspect of the mind of the way is a sense of direction. The precepts are a sense of direction. Values are a sense of direction. And then how do you act on that? And we say, you'd better start here where you are. Otherwise, you won't have any orienting point from which to move. So on one side, there's a sense of direction. If all this is a moving universe, you better have a sense of direction because it's moving. How are you moving with it? And the other side is settledness. There's a sense of direction and there's the settledness of being here. But to be settled where it's not a place, where it's not a hammock, it's not static, what does it mean to be settled in a way that's always in motion? To feel stable or settled or at ease? Because you cannot feel at ease in this moment without some sense it goes with, or that feeling at ease is the flavor of feeling sort of somehow settled and stable where you are. How does that happen in a world that's constantly in motion and seems to be forever dragging the rug out from under our feet? Seems to be, it is. Forever dragging the rug out from under our feet. Whenever we set up the furniture of our little self house, the rug gets dragged out and all the furniture falls over. And what does it mean to be settled in a world that is constantly in motion is really crucial, because if it's not clear, even in terms just of your practice, let alone the furniture of your whole life, if it's not clear, you keep striving to arrive at a kind of stillness that can only be temporary because it's achieved by pushing things out of the way. So, for instance, if you do a concentration practice, to keep it to a simple confines conceptually, a concentration practice with a candle, with incense, with something, you can have a wonderful, settled feeling for a little while. There's nothing wrong with it. It's very genuine for that little while. But it's achieved by pushing so many things out. That's how that kind of concentration works. The narrow focus pushes many things out. And they're all going to come crowding back in again. And what have you learned for the next moment? How will what you did in that moment help you in the next moment when the seas wash your life again? So it's nothing wrong with a concentration practice, and it can give you some ease and reduce stress and do many good things. And there can be insight in it. But what we're aiming for here is a practice that says, and then in the next moment when life washes over you, what will you do? So we want to do a practice in which we're not blocking so many things out, in which our being settled isn't achieved by elimination of all the problems. In Zazen, we don't do Zazen as a practice of eliminating all the problems. It's simplified. You will not be hit by trucks and traffic. It'll be reasonably quiet. It won't get too hot. You know, many things will be eased. The phone won't ring. The messages will accumulate, but you won't have to answer the phone during this time. So we simplify, but within that simplified outer simplification, you live your whole life here. You arrive here. At least that's our aim, right? Being settled, or settled in the way, in Japanese is called toji. It's equality, the mind of equality. And the mind of equality is absolutely central and core in a Soto approach. It's, you know, each Buddhist school emphasizes something different. And one of the things emphasized in Soto approach, say, to Zazen or to life or to the precepts, is the mind of equality. So mind of can be an awkward phrase. You could say an attitude of equality. I say mind of equality because it's you put on the head the thinking, the functioning of a mind, of your mind, in terms of equality. It's a little deeper than an attitude, but it includes the attitude of equality. So if the word mind seems odd or awkward, you can say, what's the attitude of equality? The mind of equality is holding all things equal, but not the same. Each thing to be taken care of with your whole heart. The thing you meet right now to take care of with your whole heart as it is, as reality manifesting. It also, each one is different. I wouldn't want to take care of one person as if they were another person, but I want to take care of each one as wholly as I can at that moment, as reality coming up. So each thing, each person, each thing, each event, each moment has to be taken care of in its individuality and difference. We're not trying to wipe away differences. Even celebrating the differences between Jude and Holly, I want to hold equally your reality as beings, your reality as Buddhas, your reality as sincere people, your reality, all the limited ways I know you. I know differences and individuality. And each one is equally reality manifesting itself. And can I meet that? Can we meet each other in those terms? This attitude of equality does not eliminate or fuzz out the differences. So the mind of equality is an attitude for relating to actual things and events. It's not just, remember we were talking, Dave and I were talking, he, I think he brought it up last week, that wasn't that, that there was, isn't this something you do, you're sitting quietly having a mind of equality, but then you have to go out and do something. Right, this kind of, and then we exchanged some had a little exchange, and he said, "Oh yeah, right. That's dualistic mind imposing itself, saying this is active, and they're different." That's our usual thinking. The mind of equality says, "At the time of sitting, live your life fully, in the context it's in right now, which is a still and quiet context in which there is still activity, or active stillness. There is activity. Zazen isn't passive." We know that. It's active, but it's a still kind of activity. It's the activity suited to this time and engagement. And then we go off into another activity and engagement, and we meet that on its terms. So maybe the mind of equality is relating to things in terms of their essential equality, while not ignoring all the equally essential differences. Because the differences are not superficial. This is a problem Buddhism has mired itself in. And many times you hear about this, you know, the merely relative world. The differences are reality expressing itself. They're not something to ignore. They're not bad. They're not minor. They're not petty. The individuality of things is the whole form of the whole of life. So to relate to things in terms of their essential equality doesn't mean you don't relate to them as distinct individual things. So, for example, in Dogen, in that Instructions for the Cook, when he's talking about, I mean, now of course he's talking to guys who probably never washed a dish in their life, right? He's talking to monks how to be in a kitchen, and but it's true for all of us. He says the mind of equality says, "Oh, this is a heavy pot. I'll put it on a low shelf because it's heavy. This is a light pot, I'll put it on a high shelf." Putting the something in the place that's appropriate to its individual qualities is treating them as treating them equally, right? With equal regard for the individual differences is an important aspect of the mind of equality. And when it gets abstract, I go back to the pots. Putting things away on the shelf that suits their nature. Or get the best ingredients available to you right now, or that you have on hand, and then make the best use of the ingredients you have without at that time wishing there were other ones. Because you can take the time you want or the little time you have to gather the ingredients for your soup, and then you use what you have, and that has to be sufficient. Rather than saying, "Oh, I wish I had something else," well, you have this. You can take a little time or a lot to gather your ingredients, and then you have this. So this is that mind of not wishing things were otherwise than they are right now, but not saying that it should be all right that I'm suffering here, or there isn't enough food to put in the pot. This is the reality right now. What am I going to do about it? And fine, you know, things fine can be peanut butter, it can be caviar. It's not. Now I tested that one out personally once. It was many, many years ago. It involved Ty, my dear friend Ty, and she lived at that time in a cabin on up a long hillside in Ashfield, Massachusetts, on the West Road, on a north-facing hill, so that the snow was deep, deep, deep always on that north-facing hill. And it was New Year's, and we were trudging up the hill. I had a nice woven pack basket and snowshoes was the only way to get it. You couldn't drive up this hill. Up the hill, this little cabin for New Year's. And in my pack, I had fresh beluga melisol caviar. Okay, this was the 70s. It wasn't quite as expensive, and we had just won, you know, some jackpot in some lottery or something, I don't know, or bingo. I didn't go myself to the bingo, although I have been known to, to accompany people. I'll go all kinds of places with people. Anyway, a bingo pot had been won, and there was enough money, and someone called from New York, who lived in the country, and said, "What can I bring?" And we said, "Ah, bingo, I know, bring some caviar, and here's give you the money." So we had this little pot of this fresh caviar. You know, it's like once in a lifetime, a whole little pot of fresh caviar. There it was, New Year's. Put it in the pack basket, climbed the hill to Taiz for New Year's, and we all had this wonderful caviar that night. And it was just a little bit for everybody. And the next day, Tai said, you know, I really like peanut butter better. I wish I had just had peanut butter. And so, you know, it's fine if you like peanut butter, and it's fine if you like caviar. And to feel afraid that it isn't is really too bad. The quality of all things is something somehow best understood in terms of our mouth. So, Aoyama Roshi, who was my only woman teacher, she's the head of the Japanese Women's Training Monastery in Nagoya, and she has an essay in this book, a collection of essays about instructions for the cook, the book called Nothing is Hidden. And she says in it, she talks about a saying, an old Japanese saying, that a monk's mouth is like an oven. And she first heard this when she was a teenager. She ordained when she was pretty young. And so her first idea was, okay, I have to eat whatever's offered to me and not get caught up in like and dislike. If it's in front of me, I'll eat it. That was, she thought, what the monk's life was. And to some extent, that's certainly what they expect in the monastery. It's served, you eat it, and you don't say, no, thank you, I won't have any either. It's going to be served, and you're going to eat it. But when she became more mature, she said, oh, a monk's mouth is not literally the mouth on my face, or not only that. This mouth, she said, is my very life, and the many different kinds of food that come into it throughout my life are the food that this monk has to eat. Said, this mouth is the whole universe, she said. The whole universe, including heaven and earth. So she says, well, how do you do this? Pleasure and sadness and failure and success and love and hatred are all served up as the food of our lives. How will we eat them? What does it mean to accept your life? What does it mean to accept what's served and transform that into the energy of your life? So this kind of accepting, I sometimes add the word radical. So we don't, it's like the words like intention, which doesn't mean wishful thinking. Acceptance is not the same as in that wonderful verse about accepting the change the things you can and accept the things you cannot change and know the difference. Well, that's excellent advice up to a point. This is different. This is a little different. This radical acceptance says, this is how it is. I will accept that fact. And then I will have some ground for doing something about it. It doesn't say, just passively receive the suffering of life. It says, oh, this is my life right now. I'm confused. I'm poor. My health is bad. I'm happy today. And am I going to grasp at all the different kinds of conditions. Here is my life right now. Can I accept that this is it right now? That this is what's offered to me right now? So that I will know how to meet it and deal with it. Not so that I will just be inundated by it. I'm more inundated when I don't know how to do that kind of acceptance. Because it's going to wash over me anyway. You know, there's a great koan that asks, what will you do when the foaming waves wash the very sky? My favorite lines, because they will. The foaming waves of our life and of the surging currents will wash us, no matter how fine our practice, will wash over our lives, no matter how prosperous or refined or how good our practice is. And how will we meet those circumstances? So this practice says, first learn to what it means to meet them, how to accept the reality of our lives so that we don't add the extra suffering of fidgeting with it, of not knowing how to settle right where we are. Settled right where I am, I'm not going to be happy about difficult circumstances, but I am more likely to be able to open my eyes and see them as circumstances, and maybe not even as myself, but as my circumstances, if I'm lucky. So, this radical acceptance is not, oh well, This is the, for those of us from places like New York, had a lot of trouble learning oh well. I had lessons for the first 10 years of the Zendo. Because New Yorkers don't say oh well.
No.
We're not engineered that way. It's not an East Coast approach. And here in Sonoma County, there was oh well. And I really didn't get it for a long time. So now I can kind of do it. But there's, you got to be careful with that. Because we're not talking about an acceptance that's a shrug. That's almost the opposite. It's an acceptance that says, this is, nor is it saying, I will embrace suffering. No. It's saying, this is as it is. This is my life right now. And I can manage to know it. That's pretty hard. I can manage the stink of my own self. That's another hard one. For instance, one of the places the time when you've just done or said something stupid. It's embarrassing, and you don't want to know yourself. You don't want to be that person. You don't want to have really been like that. There's this place where you have to stay present. If you can stay present in the stink of your own awkward, messy self, without even subsiding into shame and guilt, that's not helpful either. Just present it. You're more likely to come up with either generosity the next time someone does it to you, or the ability to say, I'm sorry. As I started learning this acceptance years ago, I discovered that it leads very quickly to a practice of apologizing. Because there you are, aware of all these things. And it's not that you should sit there and stew in what a terrible person you are. That's not helpful. So what will I do? Instead of worrying about self-consciously what I have done, maybe I can reach out to the person whose foot I stepped on and acknowledge that I did that. You know, avow, this is our repentance verse, avow our failings, our errors. So accepting means this is as it is. This is my life right now. Then accepting that this is reality, acting skillfully, you're more likely to be able to act skillfully. You will act in any case or react. Maybe then you can act with some skill, some refinement, because you have accepted the fact of where you are. So this is as it is, now what will I do with it, do about it, is an inclusive view. This is as it is, not, oh my God, I can't stand it. Just how I feel if I really messed up. No, this is as it is. This inclusive view is the mind of equality. The mind that sees the equality of things and the differences and non-sameness of things and then relates to them. So it's when I can accept things, this is as it is, with an inclusive view, that I can settle down, because what's happening here is my life. I can tolerate that this is my life. You know, Uchiyama Roshi says, everything you encounter is your life. That's a phrase that I always love because it combines a sense of direction. Everything I encounter, I'm constantly encountering life. Everything I encounter is my life. But it's my life right now. It's all of this and all of you. And it would be a much poorer life if I had evaded the responsibility of showing up. Poorer for me anyway. You all do me a great favor by showing up and I have to figure out something to say. Otherwise, I would probably put it off. In our practice of doing Zen, this mind of equality comes up in terms of neither grasping nor rejecting, which we've all heard about before. The mind of equality is the mind that says, this is as it is. I am here right now, neither grasping what the part I don't want to let go, see go away, nor rejecting the part that I wish weren't here. It doesn't say I will embrace it all and love it all to death. It says, it's the mind at the moment of not grasping at some things and pushing others away. In Zazen, that's what we're doing. We're practicing the mind of equality that sits here and doesn't grasp at some ideas and doesn't reject others and doesn't narrow down to a narrow concentration practice. Because valuable though that is, it's a practice that's also a practice of rejection and exclusion for a good purpose, but it is still a practice of exclusion. I'll only focus on this. And I'll get a nice, peaceful feeling, but I won't notice that I'm in the service of that. I'm doing a lot of pushing away and rejecting. The practice of shikantaza, of just this here and now, is being here and now, neither grasping at, oh, this is a good moment, I want to keep it. I want to get it back. Oops, gone, right? Nor rejecting, oh, God, what lousy zazen I'm doing today. It's returning to here, this moment, this inclusive moment here and there, here and now. Which is why I say, you know, we say when you ring the bell and you sit down, whatever happens then, you're sincerely aiming your life at waking up. And sometimes you're going to be full of distracted thoughts or unhappy thoughts, and sometimes you'll feel fine. And all of that, whether you feel settled or you don't feel settled, you have put yourself in the middle of settling your life. And knowing that you're doing that goes then beyond the flavor of right now I feel settled and right now I don't. Then you're kind of settled in the midst of both of those views. Right now I'm settled, right now I'm not. Right now I'm settled, right now I'm not, and I'm still here. That's the truly settled mind of equality. So this mind of equality in zazen is samadhi. The even-handedness of this mind of equality that isn't grasping and rejecting, saying this is as it is right now, this is my life right now, this is the condition in which of samadhi. So samadhi is being concentrated and aware in this moment as it is, with the mind of equality. It's not some far-off bliss state. And it's not a specially arrived at forced concentration. It's very hard for us to let go of that. It took me at least 10 years, hard case, to let go of the idea that I was striving for a particular state of mind in my zazen that I rarely had. So, of course, I felt like a failure. So I was a failure at that, but I kept doing it. And eventually I discovered that I was doing zazen sort of in spite of myself. That's the value of a really good, strong practice or tradition, that it kind of holds you. You're doing it, even though you think you're trying to do something else. And gradually you wake up to what you're actually already doing and can settle into it. The mind of equality is something you all already know. You've experienced it many times, every single one. It's evanescent for the most part in our experience. When you return to here and now, you're doing the samadhi, practicing and experiencing the samadhi of settling in your life here and now as it is, not rejecting and not grasping. Where you're meeting things then in terms of their equality. Three usually. There have been whole town meetings in Grayton about the siren, about too much siren, too loud, too often.
Is it fire?
Sometimes it's up for it. Sometimes as we like to run the siren, and it's hard. Our dear electrician Pedro was once the fire chief here, and he was one of the worst offenders. He was young then. He was a much younger guy then. He liked to ring the siren a lot. And someone said, there's another side to this, that some people feel comforted by hearing it, knowing that the siren is working so that when there is a fire, it will bring people. You see, there is always another side, that side from the one of the mind of annoyance. Anyway, nothing wrong with stopping for a moment. It's one of the flavors of our community here. When you do zazen, you are bringing forth the mind of equality. You don't have to say, how do I bring forth the mind of equality? What is that? You're doing it already. And you get to know it, and you get to live in it. And this is samadhi, and sometimes it's pleasurable and it's settling, and sometimes it's exciting, like almost like a flock of birds. And And it becomes easier to recognize this holding things equally at other times because you have a sense of the settledness of holding things equally. It's not a settledness of nailed in one place, which is never going to work. It's a settledness of holding things evenly and equally. So this doing Zazen is doing and developing the practice, the understanding in your bones and body and mind of the equality of all things. So then you can relate to things in terms of their essential equality as well as in terms of all their differences. And life unfolds. And that's enough out of me. It's time for me to stop talking. So does anyone else have anything they want to add to this? Neil?
Could you repeat that koan about washing over?
I have to look that up for you, because it's a comment, actually.